Welcome back, Hemingbrainiacs, to the Hemingbrainiacathon, the podcast of excellence. We're talking about the Red and the Black Book 2, Chapter 3. I'm going to read the schmoop for it. Wait, what chapter are we talking about? We're talking about Chapter 2, then we're reading Chapter 3. I think. Let me just refer to my book, because I've confused myself. All right, we're talking about Chapter 2, Entering Society. This is the schmoop for that chapter. Father Perard leads Julian to the Marquis de la Mole. The man is so polite and courteous that Julian is caught off guard. After the meeting, Julian goes to a tailor to get some new clothes. Julian's first tasks for the Marquis don't go well, since he doesn't spell very well. He's more of an oral learner. Julian also makes the blunder of not being properly dressed for certain hours of the day. He later meets the Marquis's wife, who barely looks at him. The Marquis's son, Count Norbert, seems like a nice enough guy. At dinner, Julian is able to win much of the family over with his knowledge of old books. Even the Marquis's wife gives him the benefit of the doubt, since he seems to amuse her husband. All right, there's a little catch-up. Dot point. Catch-up. Okay, Julian in a new setting, how do you think he will fare? That was the discussion prompt, and Jan Brunt said, he'll probably continue on the path he's tread thus far. A combo of 1, benefiting from the pettiness of those around him, 2, using his quick wit to turn his luck to great advantage, and 3, emotionally seducing those around him with his charm and youthful impetuousness. I feel like, you know what I feel about Julian? He's one of those young men with so much promise, you know, he seems quite switched on, that everyone wants to sort of give a young person, a promising young person, everyone wants to give him a bit of a leg up and give him a go and see what they can make of themselves. And that wears off, right? I'm talking from experience. Once you're like a fairly impressive, like 30-year-old, no one's doing that anymore for you. No one's like going to take you under their wing sort of thing. It's kind of like by then you've done your dash. So he's in that mode where everyone wants to help Julian because he's so promising. The thing I notice most about Julian is that he has dined out on this quoting of the Bible thing. like he's really dining out on that little skill. It's pretty much every bit of fortune that he's had has been directly or indirectly linked to his ability to quote from the memorized Bible in Latin. So if anything I've learned from this book, it's just that you should memorize the Latin Bible, and that will pretty much see you through life. You just skip from one success to the next off the back of that little skill, that little party trick. It is a party trick, because every time he's whipped out that little trick, it's at some kind of like a party or a gathering. Our treat, said Julian in a new setting. How do you think he'll fare? Probably, as he has been, somehow continuing to rise despite not really knowing how to play the game. Of course, things could catch up with him. I feel like there are limits to how far he will be able to go. I had so many highlighted passages with notes in the seminary of, like, Julian so out of place. Be careful, Julian. Oh my God, he doesn't know what he's doing, etc. We've mentioned in discussions of this book before the rigidity of the class system. He is brilliant in some ways, and definitely not in others, although so far he has been able to fumble through, tug on people's heartstrings. I am rooting for him, though, even though he is kind of douchey, and I have hope he's still so young. Many a young douche has grown into a kind and thoughtful person. Very wise words. Many a young douche has grown into a kind and thoughtful person. I think I was probably a young douche. I was a young dickhead, which is slightly different from a douche, but I was definitely, yeah, I was a dickhead, and I'm still in some ways a dickhead, but less so now. I don't think I've ever really been much of a douche, but, you know, maybe I've everyone has their moods. I've probably been a douche at some point. Swim, said the mum of fish, he said, part one, Julian has found himself to be adaptable, and then he screws it all up. Epigraph, yet again, this statement cannot be found in Kant's writings. Oh, no kidding. It's funny how there's so many, like, fake like kind of fake quotes in this. Here's a fun fact, said Swims at the Marfishy. Stendhal almost certainly took the name for de la Mole's daughter from Matilda Dębowska, the beautiful Italian wife of a Polish officer with whom he had fallen passionately in love, in Milan. I found it interesting that Julian was ignorant of moderns, Southey, Byron, George IV, though very well versed in classics. I am sure he will take the steps to rectify that. Yeah, that was funny that he had no idea. Like Byron. Right, Byron. He didn't know Byron then. I thought everyone knew Byron then when Byron was out there being Byron, because he was a bit of a rock star, wasn't he? Or maybe that's just the impression we get through a historical lens, you know, like Picasso, you think, well, like one of the most famous painters, but actually in his life, not at all. Or more so like Monet, and who were the ones that were like, there's one who was notoriously not famous until after he died. Was that Monet? Anyway, you know what I mean. But yeah, it's surprising he doesn't know Byron, but I think he's going to like Byron. I think that's what's going to happen next. Laura Weistich said, it's that epigraph sounds more like something Julian would say than Kant. Very true. I'm going to read that epigraph again. Just before we move on, seeing as we're talking about the epigraph. An absurd and touching memory, the first salon in which one appeared on one's own at the age of 18. The very glance of a woman was sufficient to frighten me. The more I tried to please, the more awkward I became. I conceived all the most mistaken ideas. Either I let down my guard for no reason, or I thought a man an enemy simply because he looked at me seriously. But even then, in the depths of terrible shyness, how very fine a fine day was. Kant, although it's not, apparently. It's funny to read that Kant quote in, it's almost like autobiographical kind of tense. And the one, the more I tried to please, the more awkward I became. Oh, God. I still feel that way sometimes. You know, especially, you know what I've noticed that recently is coming out of isolation, back into the world and trying to socialize with people. I just feel like I've forgotten how to socialize. And the more I try to just socialize normally, just do it how you've always done it. And I try, and then because I'm trying to be normal, then I inevitably just feel awkward as hell. But I remember that from being young and trying to, like, you know, when you're just getting out there in the world and trying to flirt, all that kind of thing. And it's just been like, oh, the harder I try to be normal, the more awkward I feel. Relatable. Speaking of isolation, we might be going back in just when the restrictions have all ended here. You might not know if you're not from Australia, but I live in Victoria, the state of Victoria in Australia, and all the other states have eased their restrictions back down. You can travel interstate from one to the other. Everyone's fine. There's basically no COVID going around, except for Victoria, where I live. And it's like all my interstate friends are like, come on, get your act together, Victoria. What are you doing down there? And so the whole country can fly interstate to each other, except for Victoria. We're like quarantine. Our borders are still locked down, so you can't come in and out. So we're messing it up for everyone. We had something like 80 new cases yesterday. And so we're really having a second wave here, which is not a good thing. We were sort of out of it. We basically beat it. And then the last week or so, it's just started a second wave, but just in this state. So it's really not cool. So that's that. I don't know how relatable that will be, especially if you're from America, where America just seems to have this attitude of like, if we get it, we get it. Like, For a while, you were really trying to like batten down the hatches and everyone isolate, everyone wear your mask so you don't spread it if you've got it. And then there was just all this like masks don't do anything sentiment, where it's like, they do. Like everyone, like all these memes about like masks don't, like you'll still catch it if you're wearing a mask. And it's like, yeah, we know. That's not what the mask does. The mask stops you from spreading it if you have it. And you don't know you've got it until about 2 weeks after you catch it. So that's why everyone should wear a mask. Anyway, not that Australia's been great with masks, but America, they're just like, nah, from what I'm seeing from here. And then you've had like protests and rallies and just no form of lockdown, although even though you've got like the most cases. It's so weird to watch from Australia, where we had 60 cases in this state, and everyone's like, oh God, quick, lock it back down, everyone back in your houses, you know, this is no time for public gatherings and all this. We really want to stamp it out. And then, I don't know, I see the US and it's just like business as usual, even though you've got like 500,000 people with this disease. So, I don't know. It's really, really strange. What a strange time. Not to shit on America. I know you're having a hard time over there. I don't know. It's, to my knowledge, it's the only country where there were protests about the virus. Which to me is just like, you realize you're protesting a virus. You know, like, go, just stop. Just don't. Anyway. Why are we talking about that? Let's not talk about COVID. We've got this far without talking about COVID, so let's not. Chapter 3 goes like this. It's called First Steps, and the epigraph goes like this. This immense valley full of brilliant lights and so many thousands of peoples dazzles my sight. Not one of them knows me. All are my superiors. My head swims. Poemi del Av. Rihanna. Well, it's probably not, though, let's be honest. Very early next morning, Julian was copying letters in the library when Mademoiselle Mathilda entered by a little private door cleverly concealed by the spines of the books. While Julian was marvelling at this device, Mademoiselle Mathilda appeared very much surprised and rather put out to find him there. With her hair in curling papers, she seemed to Julian to have a hard look, haughty and almost masculine. Mademoiselle de la Mole had the secret habit of abstracting books from her father's library without it being noticed. Julian's presence frustrated her purpose this morning, and that irritated her all the more because she had come to find the second volume of Voltaire's Princess of Babylon such a suitable complement to her eminently monarchical and religious education, a masterpiece of the Sacred Heart. Already at the age of 19, this poor girl required the spice of wit for a novel to interest her. At around 3 o'clock, Comte Norbert visited the library. He had come to look at a newspaper in order to talk politics that evening and was most pleased to meet Julian, whose existence he had forgotten. He behaved delightfully. He suggested they ride together. My father gives us leave until dinner time. Julian took note of this us and found it charming. Good heavens, my lord, if it was a question of felling an 80-foot tree, squaring it off and cutting it up into planks, I'd acquit myself well enough, I dare say, but getting on a horse, I've done that only 6 times in my life. Good, this will be the 7th, replied Norbert. Actually, Julian recalled to himself the entry of the King of Dash into Verrieres, and believed that he rode very well, but returning from the Bois de Boulogne, and trying to avoid a cab right in the middle of the Rue de Bourg, he fell and was covered in mud. A good thing he had 2 suits. At dinner, the Marquis, wishing to pay him some attention, inquired about the outing. Norbert hastened to reply in generous terms. Monsieur le Comte is extremely kind to me, put in Julian. I thank him for it, and feel its value to the full. He was kind enough to lend me the prettiest, most docile of his horses, but even he couldn't attach me to it. Excuse me, and for want of that precaution, I fell down plump in the middle of that long street by the bridge. Mademoiselle Mathilda vainly tried to stifle a burst of laughter, and then, in her indiscretion, asked for details. Julian supplied them with great candour. He displayed grace without being aware of it. I augur well for this little priest, remarked the Marquis of the Academician, a provincial being straightforward in such a situation. I've never seen that, and won't see it again, and even more, he's talked about his misfortune in front of women. Julian put his listeners so much at ease about his misfortune that at the end of dinner, when the conversation in general had taken another direction, Mademoiselle Mathilda demanded her brother's account of the unhappy event, her questions being prolonged, and Julian, having met her eyes several times, he had the courage to reply directly, even though he had not been asked, and all three of them ended up laughing as though they had been three young people from a village in the depths of the country. The following day, Julian went to attend two classes in theology and then returned in order to copy some 20 letters. He found a young man seated next to him in the library, carefully dressed but of disagreeable appearance and with an envious face. The Marquis came in. "What are you doing here, Monsieur Tambeau?" he asked the newcomer severely. "I thought," replied the young man with an obsequious smile. "No, Monsieur, you did not think. This is an attempt to impose, but it is not a success." Young Tambeau got up furiously and departed. He was the nephew of Monsieur de la Mole's academician friend, and had determined on a literary career. The academician had persuaded the Marquis to take him on as a secretary. Tambeau, who worked in a room apart, had learned of a favour shown to Julian, wished to share it, and that morning had come to set up his desk in the library. At 4 o'clock, Julian ventured, after some hesitation, to present himself to Comte Norbert's quarters. The latter was about to go riding and was embarrassed by this, though perfectly polite. "I believe," he said to Julian, "that you will soon be going to a riding school, and after a few weeks I will be delighted to ride with you. I wish to have the honour of thanking you for all your kindness you have shown me, and believe me, Monsieur," added Julian with a very serious air, "I feel much obliged to you. If your horse isn't hurt through my clumsiness yesterday, if it is free, I'd very much like to ride today." "Good Lord, my dear Sorel, then on your own head be it. Let's assume I've made all the objections prudence demands. The fact is that it's now 4 o'clock and we have no time to lose. Once on horseback, what do you do to stop falling off?" Julian asked the young comte. "Lots of things," replied Norbert, bursting into laughter. "Sit up straight, for example." Julian broke into a fast trot. They were in the Place Louise 16. "Hey, you young maniac," cried Norbert, "far too many carriages here, and what's more, driven by idiots. Once you're down, their tilburies will run you over. They're never going to ruin their horses' mouths by pulling them up short." 20 times Norbert saw Julian about to fall, but the outing finished without incident at last. Coming back in, the young comte said to his sister, "Allow me to present you a real bold spark." At dinner, addressing his father from one end of the table to the other, he praised Julian's courage. It was the only thing in his riding that could be praised. That morning the young comte had overheard the men grooming their horses in the courtyard, taking Julian's fall as a pretext for pitiless ridicule. Despite so much kindness, Julian felt himself very much isolated in this family. All its customs seemed alien to him, and he was always making mistakes. His blunders were the footman's delight. Abe Perard had left for his parish. "If Julian is a broken reed, let him perish," thought he. "If he's a man of spirit, let him manage his affairs for himself." All right, there we go. A fun little chapter. Quite enjoyed that. Julian making friends, riding horses, being a doofus. Have your say about that over on the subreddit. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.